This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hear about the Indivisible Movement in Central Illinois. Organizers, including Dante Lotzen with Indivisible 13, say the era of politics as usual is over.
We have to change the landscape and the definition of how we define politics.
Efforts in the 13th and 18th congressional districts so far have been to simply request a dialogue with constituents. Congressmen LaHood and Davis have not responded. Plus, what happens when the rallies are over and the banners come down on immigration reform? What is daily life like for immigrants trying to establish home places? And bringing the spirit of Finland to music, as well as the challenge of interpreting colossals like Beethoven. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're currently in a time of tumult, anger, and fear over immigration in this country. This figured prominently during the presidential campaign and continues with the deportation enforcement policy of the Trump administration. The McLean County Museum of History and the Illinois State University Latin American and Latino Studies programs have combined to address parts of this dynamic in a community reading program. The book they chose is Latino Heartland of Borders and Belonging in the Midwest. With us to talk about the work ahead of tomorrow afternoon's conversation at the Museum of History is author Suhe Vega. Welcome.
Hi, welcome. Thank you for having me.
You looked at small town Indiana and how Latinos tried to construct community and win acceptance from predecessors in the community. It's not all banners and demonstrations. In fact, very little is. What is daily life like for immigrants trying to establish their home places?
Well, I think that's one of the things that got me started in wanting to do this work is that I found that folks were purchasing homes. They were obviously working in the community alongside other members of the community. They were making friends. They were going to church. Their children were going to school. Many of them purposely moved to, you know, what would be considered downstate Indiana, like downstate Illinois, to get out of the urban centers and provide a safer place for their families to grow. So I found a lot of parallels with the local non-Latino, white and black communities of that area. So their daily life was much like the daily life of everyone else living in that town.
How did they try to get white Hoosier space to accept them?
Easier said than done, obviously. One of the things I document in the book is they would have public events, public performances, religious holidays in public, not really as an attempt to force Hoosiers to accept them, but really to say that we are part of being a Hoosier as well. And this is our land to also participate in. And so they would have these events publicly to say, you know, we're here to stay, and this is our Hoosier land as well, and we want to participate by having a public space.
Was that uncomfortable or accepted?
You know, it was interesting. So they'd done these religious holidays, for instance, like the Stations of the Cross, the Via Crucis, or the Virgin Guadalupe processions. They've been doing them for years, but this particular year when the book was written was a particular heightened political moment of a lot of intense political rhetoric against the immigrant population.
2006.
It was in 2006, exactly, so 11 years ago. And that was, for those of us that remember, when Representative Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin introduced a bill at the national level to criminalize undocumented immigrants. So I wasn't sure what to expect. They were out in public and doing the rituals they've been doing for every year, and I was actually pleasantly surprised by the amount of white Hoosiers that joined them, that marched with them, that prayed with them, that collectively came together and said, we're not going to let this national political moment infringe on the way that we react with each other. So in that case, it was nice. I was on the procession with them, and there was other situations where drivers were rude. There were some children along the procession, the religious procession, and a few almost got run over by individuals that were just impatient and not happy. But by and large, for those moments, there was a coming together of sorts.
the people who joined them, are those their natural allies? Who were those people, and how did they contrast to those who were doing ethnic slurs and workplace intimidation and things like that?
So because predominantly what I researched was white Catholics, I also did some research and interviews with, Latino Catholics, but Latino Baptists, Latino Mormons as well. But what I saw with the processions, it was other white Catholics who said, you know, we have more in common than separates us. And so these were natural allies because they celebrated the same faith. And they came out and said, you know, we're one in our faith. We are one as a people. And this was in contrast to letters to the editor, really mean, horrific comments, political flyers that were sent that created this image that this community was criminal, was violent, was a danger to the locality. And the folks that went to church with Latinos, worked with Latinos, were neighbors with Latinos, knew better. And they, some individuals came out in support with them.
How did they react to the horrible things that were going on? What was the impact on them?
On Latinos?
Mm-hmm.
The first few letters to the editor were, again, pretty harsh, mean, spirited. And I remember a few attempts where people wrote back. And so the educated community members, the folks that had a formal education, tried to create a few letters that were attempting to counter the discourse, to counter the rhetoric, but they quickly found out that they were going to, for every positive letter written in, there was at least 7 to 10 negative ones in response to that positive one. So instead of focusing on letters to the editor, they thought, okay, let's get a fiesta together. Let's get a community event together where we showcase who we are, our culture, our identity, our neighborhood's collectivity, instead of the criminality that's being broadcasted nationally. So they did events. They did a party, a fiesta, where they had food, they had dancing, they had music, to showcase that positive part of their contributions.
Did things ease?
I think so. I mean, obviously, it's slow going. You had more people come together. And the important, so that happened, the first one was in 2007. And it's been going on ever since. And so that was, it was a coming together of folks in 2006 to plan it for 2007. And it's 2017, and they just had one, I believe. So
that was a moment of high tension nationally. We're in another moment of high tension. Does the previous instance provide any guide for dealing with the present atmosphere?
One of the things I talk about towards the end of the book is, and in fact in the conclusion chapter, is what this means for other communities, right? That obviously this was Central Indiana. It's a particular case. But it's not that particular. You have communities across the nation that are going through the same distraught interactions that are fueled sometimes by politics. And one of the things I mentioned there is what needs to be done is people coming together, talking to each other, seeing each other as humans, and not the rhetoric that, unfortunately, they're being fueled, that politicians are fueling.
One of the places, though, where that happens the most is also a place that tends to have ethnic tensions, mm-hmm. the workplace. Mm-hmm. There's workplace segregation that you
yes.
note in third shift
yes.
For Latinos,
yes.
or the boiler room
yes.
Being relegated to the kitchen. How does that change over time, and how can that be accomplished?
Well, I think one of the things is, you know, Latino workers, especially immigrant Latino workers, are afraid to speak up because they're afraid of what that means for their job security. And so you won't often find them saying, you know, can I get the second shift, or I'd really rather not work in the boiler room. But often it takes the case of someone else saying, you know, Jose's done an amazing job. Let's move into a different shift. So they need allies. They need coalitions of folks that are going to speak up for them and with them to create a better environment for them in the workplace. Because I honestly think that a lot of workers have obviously more in common than that separates them. They work in the same environment. They get paid almost similar.
Oh, do they?
Well, sometimes not. But, you know, they get they're working class, right? They're men and women that are working class folks. And I believe they have more in common in terms of their struggles than politicians or the media would have us believe. So
this is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Suhi Vega, an anthropologist at Arizona State University, who's in Bloomington Normal to talk about her book, Latino Heartland, as part of the Community Reads partnership between ISU's Latin American and Latino Studies program and the McLean County Museum of History. There is an expectation by white Hoosierdom of assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
And the comparison is often made in not just in Indiana, but in central Illinois as well, to the German experience of assimilation, mm-hmm. where you give up the language, you keep some of the cute ethnic customs, but not the core identity. Is that how do Latinos react to that expectation and that stereotype?
I think there's two things to be said about that. One is, historically speaking, right, Germans in particular weren't ones to immediately give up their heritage, their customs, their identity.
So it's false, then.
Yeah, it's a false narrative, exactly. So that what my book talks about is in this particular German community, folks fought tooth and nail, sometimes against religious figures that were their superiors, to maintain language, to maintain culture and identity. And unfortunately, right, we're up on the anniversary of World War
One,
and its impact on the German population. And for me, that's a cause of reflection, because if we think about what those families went through, that's a lot of pain. That's a lot of suffering. That's a lot of shame that these communities had to go through. And I think present-day Latinos don't want that for their children. Right.
Well, what the Germans went through was language law exclusion.
Exactly.
It was economic discrimination. Mm-hmm. It was cross burnings in front of their yard
exactly.
by the Klan. It was slaughtering of dachshunds as an image of the German Kaiser.
Right.
It was all of this this horrible stuff.
Right.
And how are we that close to what's happening now?
I feel we are, actually. I live in Arizona, but that's not a particular case. I think that we probably have cases of them here in Illinois and Indiana. And I don't think it has to be as obvious as a cross-burning. I talk about in the book that there's felt rejections, or rechazo, as we say in Spanish, which is just those snubs, microaggressions, those moments where you just don't feel like people welcome you in a space. And no, those aren't crosses being burnt in your front yard, but you don't feel welcomed. And I think that's obviously still going on with this population. And one thing I wish would happen more is that reflection piece, the reflection of our ancestors, if you're German, or even if you're not German, right, what they must have gone through, and not wanting to perpetuate that same animosity towards the present day.
Give us a couple examples of that, would you? Microaggressions and small unthinking betrayals of your own, of a mindset that is exclusionary.
So, for instance, one happened. I talk a lot about Walmart in my book because Walmart came up again and again as a space of interaction, a space where people, and this goes back to their all working class communities, they interact because this is the place where they shop, because this is the place where they can afford their goods. And so often Walmart becomes a space where people sometimes see each other, and sometimes that creates tension. And in one case, there was a mom, young mom. She was Mormon, a Latina mom, and she had, I want to say, three small kids. And she was teaching her kids how to speak Spanish because she wanted to make sure that they learned both languages. And so she asked them in Spanish to go grab something from the aisle. And two women were in the aisle, two white women, older white women were in the aisle. And one says to the other, "These Mexicans with their kids," in a very disparaging tone. And the mom, who happens to be Mexican-American and knew English, obviously, being raised here, turns to the women and says, "Yes, aren't my children a blessing?" Right? And in that moment, she counteracts the negativity, right, that these women were doing. They were chastising this woman as being over-fertile, for having too many kids, for being irresponsible, et cetera, all the stereotypes we have. And this mom really was offended, but instead of turning it, right, in a negative way, she turned it back on them and said, you know, my children are a blessing and I appreciate them. And she did so in English to assert that she knows English as well. So that's a sort of microaggression, because these women had no idea this other woman spoke English. And so they felt that it was safe to be negative in that way.
Well, let's look at the use of language. I mean, non-Latinos often view use of Spanish as self-segregation. Mm-hmm. How can that barrier be surmounted?
Well, I think one thing we have to think is past, and I'll talk about this a little bit, that we have to think past the notion of being bilingual as a negative. Unfortunately, we in our country want to say that you have to speak English, you have to speak it today, as in yesterday, and you have to learn it quickly. It's not an easy process, and those of us that learn a different language know it's a difficult thing to learn two languages. But for many families, the reason they speak Spanish is because they want to maintain it. It's a skill to be bilingual. Obviously, in this global world, it's a skill to have two languages, and they know that their children are learning English in school. That's an obvious, but they want to make sure their children don't forget the Spanish, because those two things together make for a much richer experience. And economically speaking, it makes for a better workforce as well, to have more than one language. So I think that we have to rethink the way that we see bilingual or other languages spoken in our environment. It's not negative. It's actually a positive to have these languages being spoken about.
Is there optimism in the difference between first and second generation immigrant experiences?
So it's interesting. It depends on the area and the region. Sometimes first generation, that is the immigrant experience, struggles with the language, struggles with the new environment, struggles with the workplace. And their children navigate this world a different way, right? They are sometimes born here. They are definitely raised here. They know the culture. They know the language. And that would seem to be a great thing because they can navigate both worlds. But sometimes those children get caught up in not knowing which one to be. And it's made even that much worse by a society that forces them to assimilate. And so there's a crisis moment for some second generation Latinos who, on the one hand, are very proud of their family and what they're coming from. On the other hand, you have a society telling them they have to assimilate. And so it's a difficult process for some. And what I found that in this case, the second generation was actually really helpful in defending the first generation, in asserting a right to belong, in defending their parents against some of the vile discussions happening by politicians locally as well as nationally.
Professor Suhey Vega is the author of Latino Heartland of Borders and Belonging in the Midwest. That's the Community Reads book being discussed Saturday at the McLean County Museum of History in downtown Bloomington at 1 p.m. Thanks so much for joining us.
Support for JLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jacksguarantee.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Activist groups and sometimes outspoken audience members at congressional town hall meetings around the country may be relying on a guide written by a couple of former congressional staffers. It's called Indivisible, a practical guide for resisting the Trump agenda, and it's being employed by groups in Central Illinois. Two Central Illinois groups, Indivisible 13 and Indivisible 18, named for a couple of the targeted congressional districts, are using the guide. Susan Cortese is a representative of the group targeting 18th District Congressman Darren LaHood. She attended a rally outside LaHood's Bloomington office on Thursday afternoon. Republican Rodney Davis represents the 13th Congressional District, and Dante Lotson is with Indivisible 13. Lotson tells GLT's Mike McCurdy the Indivisible Guide takes a page from the conservative Tea Party movement, which influenced politics during the Obama presidency.
They caused commotion. Their voices were heard, and they were able to rally a base of people to step up and get them to understand their power, their concerted power as a group. And I think that's what I can appreciate about the movement itself.
I think the whole idea of resistance and fighting back are the things that we're going to take mm-hmm. and hold true to.
The Tea Party may have been more focused on members of the GOP than Democrats, in fact, seeing any compromise with Democrats by Republicans as a betrayal. What is Indivisible's approach here, and do you even have the opportunity to work with Democrats in Central Illinois? the congressional districts are dominated by Republicans.
Well, we're finding that very, very difficult, but we're not giving up on that. We are repeatedly going to offices and talking. I know there have been many meetings with Representative LaHood's staff. They've been kind and courteous and have met with us and talked. From what I understand, 13 hasn't had the same success with Rodney Davis's meetings. But those are the kinds of things that we're trying to do, is to reach out to them and see what we can do. And if we can't reach them, then the change is going to need to be made.
Yeah, and Mike, what it comes down to, this isn't about partisanship. This is about caring, servant leaders who have not forgotten their responsibility. And if they are here for the greater good of humanity, then these are the people that we want to get behind. Conversely, if they're not doing what they need to do, then once again, they're going to hear from us.
Well, certainly what
it doesn't make a difference which side of the aisle they're on.
Certainly what the GLT newsroom has heard from Davis's office is that they do think it's political. It is partisan.
For me, I think it's as simple as this. It all comes down to the policies and actions. Let's stick with Davis for a minute. He came to the YWCA not too long ago, and he was touting the importance of Title IX at universities, ensuring that people would be protected from sexual assault. And then the presidential candidate at the time, Trump, it was determined his words in the past about women, and then he went on record and said that he no longer supported him. Then he went, Trump won the election, and the next comment from Davis was, "We're really looking forward to working with him and his administration." That's incongruent. Where do you stand now? So for me, my push is, where are you? And what happened between the time that he said or made those comments, or that it was released that he made those comments, for you to say that you would not support him, and now you're a fervent supporter?
Isn't that just politics as usual?
You know, I think so. But here's where I stand. We're tired of that. We're tired of politics as usual. This is about people. It's we the people, not the people who are elected who get to do whatever they want and whatever they choose, even when it's not in our best interests. It's time for us to step up and to say we have to change the landscape and the definition of how we define politics. And a part of that is getting away from this is politics as usual.
The indivisible guide that both the indivisible Illinois 18 and 13 are using says that the congressman's most important goal is to be reelected. How are you working with that notion?
You know, as Dante said, we're trying to cross the traditional boundaries, and if we can do that and they speak for us, then we're okay. But if not, then we have to replace them.
What do you have working in your favor with the indivisible movements, such as numbers, the number of people who have become involved? Susan, I know you're a brand new activist. You're somebody who was not politically active before.
I was never politically active. In fact, I showed up to that first meeting and sat there with my husband, who is kind of politically involved. His mother was a stumper for Robert Kennedy, and he grew up in a home where they talked about activism, and I did not. I grew up in a quiet Republican home, and I went there that day, and I sat and listened. And I've been a teacher. I was a teacher for 35 years, and what I saw happening in politics didn't represent the best of what my students and the families of my students needed, and I just no longer could sit back. And that day, I was really actually inspired by Dante's words. He said, "I have mixed children, and I'm concerned about the life that we're creating and building for them." And I, too, raised a mixed child. And I am concerned about where things are going for him. And that's one of the reasons I got involved.
How many people are involved with Indivisible 18?
Indivisible 18, we hit 501 members this morning.
And Dante, how many are involved with the Indivisible Illinois 13?
It's just right around 500
as
well.
Yeah, around 500.
So is this bigger than the Tea Party was at this point? Is there any way to compare that? Do you think you're a bigger movement than the Tea Party was?
I think we're
already
still in the forming phases. We're just 500 in McLean County. Tonight, I'm going to get on the phone with Peoria, and I'm going to get on the phone with somebody from Champaign, and we're going to talk and start comparing. And I'll have more of an idea of what's going on. But already, we have all these smaller grassroots pockets forming around the state. So IL 18, while it's McLean County's group, it is not the only 18 group out there.
Mm-hmm. As a brand new activist, Susan, what do you make of this whole paid protester narrative being perpetuated by the president, no less, and by some congressmen? There's no evidence that protesters are being paid, but the assertion is still out there.
It's a tactic. It's the way that they can throw off our message. They're going to have us fight against something that doesn't matter. We aren't paid protesters. You go out there and you stand in that group, and it's authentic passion. And people are really angry about things that are happening, and they want their voices heard. And people who are paid to do that job don't have the kind of passion that you see in the protesting groups.
I would just say that we're unfortunately in a day and time where alternative facts reign king, and whatever you can do to discredit something that's going against politics as usual, I think that's the approach. And it's unfortunate because I think the American public should take offense to that, quite frankly, because it all hinges upon the fact that or this thought that Americans will not go and get educated, that they're just going to take whatever it is that you say and their word is bond. And I don't think it makes any sense at all. And I think what's happening, if there's anything positive that has happened over the last several weeks up to a month, it's been that it's I won't say the person's name, but what they call the Great Awakening. And I think that's happening, and people are rising up. It's not there's nothing negative. There's no violence associated with it. People are ready to wake up, and they are beginning to understand how we all intersect, and that if we don't step up when something happens to a neighbor, then we're next in line. And I think people are just absolutely tired of that.
Where are these two movements, Illinois, Indivisible 13 and 18, where are you in terms of wanting to work with Darren LaHood and work with Rodney Davis and pivoting toward working to put somebody else in their place?
I think we need to talk to them. I think they need to show up for a citizens forum. I know they call them town halls, but we really need to have a dialogue. And right now, we have no dialogue with them.
What about Davis's offer to do the
teletown hall?
The teletown hall.
I will be curious to see how that works. I'm going to sit back and look at it. I'm obviously in LaHood's district. I feel that for me to stand up and talk to Davis would be taking a place of somebody there that belongs in that conversation.
Well, Dante, what do you think of the telephone town hall?
I don't like it. I'll just be very honest with you. When these guys were seeking election or re-election, there was no talk about a teletown hall. They showed up. They did what they needed to do in order to get the votes. So if you did that and you feel so confident about the work that you're doing, then show up. This is not foreign territory. You're talking about your own constituents. Show up. That's how I feel about it.
Is Indivisible 13 and 18 on the defense or the offense? What game are you playing right now, Dante?
I would say that it's neither. I think that our focus is on, once again, it's about doing the right thing, and it's about overall humanity. What's the greater good? How do we reach the greater good where Everyone is accounted for, not just those who are in the top 1%, but also the low and middle income people, the folks who are just barely getting by, who are left aside and who are often forgotten, and quite frankly, who those typically that don't have a voice.
That sounds more like offense to me. It's less blocking and obstructionism of the congressman and more sort of thinking about legislation and policy that will help people.
I would say that's true. It's Indivisible was set up to provide help to people. How do you go about reaching out to your representatives and your senators? And what do we do about it? What do we say? And how can we reach them? Mm-hmm. And that's what it was really formed for. Mm-hmm. How do we get out there and get on the ground and make some things happen?
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with representatives of Indivisible Illinois 18 and 13. Can you sustain this movement? There's a lot of energy right now, but it's a long game. Here's what U.S. Senator Dick Durbin told Charlie Schlenker during a recent interview.
There's a lot of emotion, a lot of energy, and what I've said to him is what we face is a marathon, not a sprint. Be prepared. Do your homework. Get involved locally. There are plenty of races, city races and others that you can get involved in to test your skills and to get to know your neighbors a little better. But this is going to be a long-term undertaking. It's a real test in our political process.
U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, in an interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, says it's a marathon, not a sprint. Susan, what do you think?
It definitely is a marathon. I'm an arts, former arts teacher, so I liked what Madonna said. It's like being in a choir and having a long sustained note. And sometimes you have to take a breath within that long sustained note. But there are other people around you helping you sustain that note. And that's what we have to do. One of the things that we've talked about is how do we remain healthy and how do we remain positive and how do we remain resistant through these definitely 4 years coming up.
Dante, can either group overcome how the districts are actually drawn if these groups, if the Indivisible movements in Central Illinois decide, you know, it's time to back another congressman, somebody from another party, not a Republican? Can you actually overcome how the districts have been gerrymandered?
That will be a challenge. But first things first, what we do hope to come out of this is that there will be viable candidates to push these elected officials. And they need to know and understand that they're going to have to show up and start listening to the people and
that's the first segment.
That's the first step, just to have a conversation with the candidates
who are in office currently. Where's the line, do you think, with being annoying enough to get noticed, but not so annoying that you won't be taken seriously or that the congressman will just be able to say, you know, this group is... They're wacky. They're out there.
I think we have to do our homework. We have to know what the bills are. We have to know what's involved in them, who's behind them, who's voting on what, and what they're about. And if we don't know what's really going on and we're just shouting about things we care about, then we really aren't going to be taken seriously.
So specifics, detail-oriented.
We're working really hard on detailing exactly what is behind the issues that we care about and who's doing what and who's involved with them.
What do you both say to people who say, you know, Trump won, move on, this is just sour grapes over losing? What do you say to those people? Dante, I'll ask you first.
I would have them take a look at his policies, take a look at his decisions, take a look at his first 3 weeks in office. And you clearly understand that this is not about you losing or you're being salty because your candidate didn't win. This is not about comfort or convenience, Mike. This is about life and death for many people, which to me merits a great deal of interest and activism on the part of the people who want to see a change. So, I don't put a lot of stock into that. I mean, I think here's what the other piece I would say: if you really feel that way, then we need to sit down and have a conversation.
And Susan, same question. It sounds like Dante is not moving toward normalizing the current administration, says it's not sour grapes. What do you think?
It's America. We have a right to speak up, and he's not speaking for us. Nothing that I'm seeing coming out of the White House right now represents the kind of world that I want to live in. I am so disappointed in the fact that we don't have the same kind of feelings about reproductive rights, that they want to get rid of health insurance for people who have fought for years to get on. I have a mother-in-law who had a pre-existing condition, and we were never able to get her any kind of insurance because of that. And as a result, I believe she died of her problems as a result of that. And it was very frustrating. I mean, we would have paid what we needed to pay to do that, but because of the pre-existing. And now they're saying they just want to get rid of that. I can't stand idly by. I can't accept what they're saying I need to accept.
Is that why you got involved? Is that part of the reason you got involved? Because of your mother-in-law?
I think I got involved because of my husband, watching him and dealing with this. And definitely in the name of my mother-in-law, Dorothy. I just have watched my husband. He called it early on. He thought that this might be what's going to happen and that that Trump would get into the White House. And I didn't believe him. And I have watched him many a sleepless night deal with the feelings that he has about all of the policies that go against everything he believes. And I couldn't sit idly by anymore. I had to be supportive. And I believe in what he believes in, and together we're going to fight this.
And you're a retired school teacher,
I'm
right?
A retired school teacher, newly retired, so I have some time now.
Congratulations. Dante, you're still employed. You're managing a nonprofit. Any concern that your involvement in this movement will affect your professional career, fundraising for your nonprofit?
So it's a yes and no. First things first, I'm always clear about what my role is in the community. And whenever the YW is involved, because we are 501c3, it obviously cannot be partisan. Of course, there are concerns. But the way I look at this, Mike, is if I was afraid to step up and do the right thing out of fear, then I really have no right to call myself a caring human being or a leader. And being a servant leader means that you have to step up, and you don't just show the way, you go the way. And you have to be able to lead the way and to let people know that you're not afraid. So I know that there could be some potential negative outcomes of this, but I'm willing to take the chance because it's the right thing to do.
And there is some overlap with your organization.
Yes.
I mean, in
yes.
the mission statement, it talks about empowering women.
That's right. That's right.
Why did you get involved? Same question I asked Susan.
I would have to say my mom. My mom is an activist at heart. When she was in elementary school, she refused to stand for the flag, pledge allegiance at the time, because of the political strife that Angela Davis was going she was under attack at the time. Mm-hmm. And so, and living in this skin every single day and having an opportunity to be blessed enough to lead a women's organization where I learn every single day from the incredible women and men who are part of the organization. And if I wasn't out doing this community work, I wouldn't be doing my job.
This doesn't look like a playbook for bipartisanship. The indivisible playbook doesn't look like it would lead to more bipartisanship. At what point do you think the political climate actually needs to change? Susan? On both sides. Or Dante, either one. I mean, it does take members from both parties to really get at good legislation or good policy. So is that somewhere off on the horizon?
You know, I'm hopeful. I mean, when you look through American history and American politics, you see that some of the very best legislation that's been offered, it's been co-sponsored. It's been people from both sides of the aisle. And we do have to get out of this entrenchment. But at the same time, what I want to be very, very, very careful of is
sharing that I don't believe in compromise for the sake of saying that we compromised. You know, for example, I'll use this in, you know, from what I understand, the state of Illinois was funded 50% for education 20 years ago. 20 years ago, 50%. Now that's less than 18%. So what do you mean we have to compromise? What is there to compromise? There's nothing we should be compromising. There is time to set this straight and have a better balance. So I don't believe there's compromise in there. So I think there are some things that you can compromise on and then some things that you just have to buckle down and fight for. And to me, that is not a partisan issue. That just comes down to doing what's right. So as you, if you are a candidate, and as a part of your speech, you go around and you tout the importance of education, and then you continue to take away from it, I don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, Independent, it makes no difference to me. It's wrong. If our kids are the future, then you're taking it away, it's wrong.
It goes back to what you were saying about walking the walk.
Yeah.
Susan, what do you want to
add? I was just going to say that, you know, I was brought up to vote for the man or the woman who had the ideals and the care for human beings. And that's what I've always looked at. And right now I'm not seeing it on the other side. And it really, I was a registered Republican. I'll be honest about that. And I have not voted Republican very much in the last, I'd say, 15 years.
Dante Lotson is representative from Indivisible Illinois 13. Susan Cortese is with Indivisible Illinois 18. Thanks to both of you for your time on Sound Ideas today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Mike.
Lotson and Cortese spoke with GLT's Mike McCurdy. At this point, Indivisible 13 and 18's primary goals are to get Congressman Davis and LaHood to hold a face-to-face dialogue with constituents. Since the Trump inauguration, Davis and LaHood have not held face-to-face town hall meetings.
Put down that rabbit's foot. Don't bother with that wishbone. At GLT's Trivia Night, it's brains, not luck, that will take you to the top. Put your team together and come to the Castle Theater March 4th for a battle of the brains. Don't knock on wood. Get out your best brains and show us how smart you are. At GLT Trivia Night, March 4th at the Castle Theater. More info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Peoria Riverfront Museum, welcoming visitors aboard Titanic, the artifact exhibition, featuring authentic artifacts and extensive recreations, plus a variety of Titanic-themed special activities for children, teens, and adults. Schedule and details at riverfrontmuseum.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A backer of classical music composer Jean Sibelius wrote him before he composed the Second Symphony that it was time for him to go to Italy, a country where one learns cantabile, balance and harmony, plasticity and symmetry of lines, a country where everything is beautiful, even the ugly. You remember what Italy meant for Tchaikovsky's development and for Richard Strauss. This brings up an interesting question for conductor Ken Lamb, who takes the stage with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra tomorrow in Bloomington. Haydn was Haydn wherever he went. Dvorak looked for native influences in his travels. For some people it matters, for some it doesn't. What, Ken Lamb, was the importance of place in composing for Sibelius?
Oh, gosh, I think it's just kind of inspiration, because I think when he was in Italy, he jotted down a couple of themes for the second movement of the Second Symphony. But I don't think the themes he jotted down at the time were meant as part of the Second Symphony. I think he wrote one theme. I think the first theme he called it Don Juan, and the second he called it Christus. So if people are thinking, well, you know, is it a tone poem that he's about to write? But it all showed up in the Second Symphony, which, you know, Sibelius was really, I believe, trying to make the symphonic form his own. And you see his progression from the first to the seventh, or, well, I guess the eighth, but he destroyed it. But we have seven symphonies that really sort of his attempt to make the symphonic logic something of his own.
And it was a bold thing to do coming after Beethoven.
Absolutely.
So what did he do in number two to to try to establish himself and his identity with that form.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you look at the way he uses material. You know, he still works, like in the first movie, he still works within the traditional sonata principle. The way he combines materials, the way he uses, cycle them, develop them, it's not a sonata in its traditional sense. For instance, the second movement, you can even call it a sonata without development. But the materials itself, it's subject to development as they are presented. Now, you talked about Beethoven just now, you know, how can a composer find symphonic logic after Beethoven? And of course, the second symphony of all the symphonies of Sibelius actually pays homage to Beethoven's symphonies. You just have to look at the transition between the third and fourth movement. Well, they are linked just in the same way that Beethoven's fifth symphony between the third and fourth movement are linked. And that was, of course, the first time that's in symphonic literature that any composer has done. Also, really, the trajectory from darkness to light, from struggle to triumph, that also harks back at an earlier time. So it's an interesting symphony. Of course, the composition and the reception also, I think, has some differences.
The reception? How?
Well, you know, people at the time, the Finns were under Russian rule, but towards the end of the 19th century, because of, you know, increased Russian censorship and so on, there's a great sense of identity. You know, the Finns spoke, of course, the upper class spoke Swedish, not Finnish, but the working people, they started to really think.
Sweden had owned Finland for a number of centuries.
Indeed, before the Russians, and but there are Finnish legends, for instance, those epics and the language, and people started to really have a feel for the national identity. And when the Second Symphony came out, you know, just because of the way it sounded, there's so much struggle in the second movement, and there's so much hope in the last. They sort of took this to sort of mean, well, is this a call for some sort of nationalism?
Well, in choosing the Second Symphony at this time, did you intend anything by it, given the role of Russia right now? Dive, 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 he's saying.
Oh, yeah. That's... I think it's. One can look at the world around us and make all sorts of references. I think, for me, the principle of struggle and overcoming difficult times, it's part of the human condition.
Well, let's talk about struggle, because obviously world events can serve as a seed for the struggle in music, but. Other composers have been relatively happy and stress-free. I mean, Mendelssohn, Copland, a lot of the British pastoralists had pretty happy lives. Do horrible things in the world have to be a prerequisite for great music?
I don't think so. But artists generally react to the world around us. I mean, you only have to look at what happened to the direction of music in the early parts of the 20th century to understand that. You know, that is when, you know, you see all sorts of dissonance, and not just in music, but in all art, that I think really the artist is reflecting what is going on in the world. You know, the movement of expressionism in particular, you know, just really relating to what emotions we all have. But it is true that some composers, like Mendelssohn, was able to churn out very, very fluent and happy music. But I guess those music by composers like Mendelssohn also reflect his livelihood and his times. And there are sort of struggles in Mendelssohn's music too, but I think it's contained in its context.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Ken Lamb, who's conducting the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in Bloomington Normal on Saturday. Also on the program is Beethoven's Violin Concerto, one of the big violin concerti. And the soloist is Dutch violinist Simone Lamsma. Can Beethoven's Violin Concerto be freshened and yet remain recognizable in your interpretation of it?
The greatest music has a logic to them that when you start the composer, you know, just take Beethoven's Violin Concerto. The timpani starts the concerto with four strokes. First of all, you know, how incredibly modern is that, you know, just in terms of daring, you know, having a timpani to start, but really not as, you know, it doesn't do a roll, it doesn't do a crash or bang, but four strokes piano, played piano. And I think Beethoven's was able to take that initial thought into his logical conclusion. Virtuosic violin concerto by any means. It's difficult, but in itself,
just it's playable.
It's playable. You know, you can put your fingers around it. But yet, you know, you have Jascha Heifetz, the greatest of violinists, say the concertos Beethoven and Mozart are the hardest, simply because on the surface it is not technically challenging like a Tchaikovsky violin concerto.
Well, for instance, with the Elgar Cello Concerto, it's the teachers always say they don't give it to students too early because they're not ready for the phrasings. They're not ready for the small interpretive subtleties. What kind of subtleties are we talking about in the Beethoven?
It's interesting. You mentioned the Elgar Cello Concerto because that, the whole emotive essence of that piece is you have to understand the place of the British Empire during Elgar's time. So I don't think if you do not understand history and that particular era, it's very difficult to bring out that sentiment. Beethoven, I think, is a little different. Beethoven, I'm not sure it's programmatic, this music. Beethoven is most capable of writing programmatic music, just like a symphony written around the same time as the Violin Concerto, the Pastoral. But this Violin Concerto, I don't think it's programmatic in that sense.
Ken Lamb is a finalist for the music director's position at the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, which is performing music of Sibelius and Beethoven tomorrow evening at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the interviews and stories today from Mike McCurdy on our website, along with the full show, podcast, and archive. Our website is also where you can get started with telling us what you think of Sound Ideas, or go to Facebook and post about the show at facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.